Public health for a long time only occasionally made the headlines. Then we all lived through the COVID crisis, and we were introduced to a new range of experts on our screens. One of the foremost was Professor Linda Board, expert on public health in general and the dangers of smoking in particular, and who combines academic research with getting our hands dirty, offering advice and devising policy. Back in 1604, King James I of England declared smoking as a custom loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs, and of the black, stinking fume thereof, nearest resembling the horrible Stygian smoke of the pit that is bottomless. 418 years on and millions of deaths later, why is it that around 14% of the UK population still smokes? Professor Linda Board should know. She's the Bruce and John Usher Chair in Public Health in the Usher Institute, College of Medicine and the University of Edinburgh. And she's also Chief Policy Advisor to the Scottish Government. For this work and for guiding the public health response to COVID, Professor Board was awarded an OBE last year. Thanks so much for giving up your time to join us on the We Society. Welcome, Professor Linda Board.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
We call this podcast series the We Society. And when we contacted you and invited you to do a turn for us, what was your thought about being on the We Society podcast? What did that phrase suggest to you?
Well, I think it's actually a good phrase for public health, because I suppose to me the We Society means that everybody is part of society and everyone is together, because we means we together, and society is, you know, the world, the communities that we live in. And in public health, what we do is we don't just focus on the individual. We are operating at looking at the health of whole populations. So if you will, the whole population, the society, is our patient. So for me, it's a good phrase.
I like the idea of the whole society being your patient, because we devised this notion of the We Society as in a kind of a tension to kind of ultra-libertarianism, the I Society, and actually you can't do things like even roll out a vaccine program successfully without some sense of the we.
That's right. And I think the issue with vaccines and public health interventions is it is about recognizing that there may be things that individuals do that disadvantage others, and there may be others do that what others do that disadvantage us and affect health, whether you think about air pollution, clean water, smoking, a vaccine program not rolling out successfully. Let's take measles for children, for example, and then the disease popping up again. So when we invest in public health interventions, from vaccines through to policy, we're asking individuals to engage with something for the good of society, for the good of the group, not just for their own health, although their own health will benefit if all of us do it together.
Let's just stay on this big picture and then drill into some particular examples. I mean, whether it's the success of or not of getting people to actually get vaccinated, whether it's wearing masks, blowing your nose, there's all kinds of dimensions of this. But it seems to be that it's harder to make this case in 2022 than it was 50, 60 years ago.
I think that's probably, there is a political dimension to that, and also there may be a technological one as well. I think if you look across the globe, actually our response to COVID or pandemics has been different, and there's all sorts of analysis now looking at, if you look at vaccine programs or a pandemic, how countries have responded differently. And in North America, in Europe, in the UK, we live in liberal democracies where we have seen the rise of the right, the political right, which has an individualistic approach to policymaking. And in some countries, particularly the US, but, you know, we have many common features as well. The rights of the individuals, whether they are around free speech or in the case of the US still to bear arms, are things that people feel very strongly about. So there is this continued tension between the group and our individual rights. And I think that has made things difficult. And it's probably also contributed to a disinvestment in public health in recent years. When you had the big public health threats of the past, let's look back to the industrial era, where it was about clean environments, access to clean water, basic medicines, when people were crowded together in unsanitary conditions. Reformers were, I think, maybe more successful in that period, making the case for that population level approach. And I think it is harder nowadays to do that.
And yet, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, as was, and actually his defenders in the Conservative Party, always boasted about the success of the vaccine rollout. He would say, follow the science. His preference was for great take-up of vaccines so you could more quickly exit lockdown. I mean, he saw that trade-off very clearly. I mean, it's a complicated story, and ups and downs, too, in the... At one point, it looked as though Britain was doing terribly. Then it looked as though it was ahead. People were saying how successful China has been and other Asian societies, and now that's less certain. How do we pick our way through this, through the complexities of this? What's your settled view?
In 2020, when I decided to switch my attention much more to COVID and to try and make my contribution to addressing the crisis, one of the first things my department did, and I coordinated it, was set up a series of seminars, webinars, where we invited colleagues from a whole variety of different countries, a different country each week, to speak about their experience. We had some very eminent people from Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Australia, Chile, the list goes on. And it was really interesting in the early stages of the pandemic. We described successful and less successful countries, the UK being one. And then as you move through, as you rightly point out, Will, the kind of perception of who was doing well if you use mortality as the litmus test or the marker shifted. And what I would say is that I'm quite hesitant to make these broad brush comparisons. There are many papers on this, but I think there are different ways of interpreting this. You could argue that the most successful countries were those that took action early, that had robust public health systems that they ramped up really quickly, and that in the end didn't damage their economies irreparably. And some of them had geographical advantages, like New Zealand, in doing that. Although I think if you worked in the airline industry in New Zealand, you'd argue that It wasn't the right approach. Taking a broad picture.
And now New Zealand doesn't look quite so clever, does it? I mean, it's not.
It doesn't. To those stakeholders. And the same if you were in South Korea that had experienced SARS, they just were ready for it and they managed to strike a good path through, I think. There are public inquiries on this and they were poor over it. The European response generally was to be hesitant about taking swift action. And the other thing is the pandemic preparedness we have, which was for pandemic flu, not this pandemic, didn't recognize the importance of ramping up testing infrastructure very quickly and just frankly didn't recognize early signs around how this virus was behaving, the risks of asymptomatic transmission, etc. But the first point you made about was vaccines, where the UK was a leader, and it is a success story. But that is, again, linked back to your previous question about public health and individualism. What the UK has is a biomedical model of medical science, where innovation and medicines and technologies are how we regard, what we regard as a priority for science, from cancer through to, rare diseases that we try to treat. And therefore, focusing on the medicine, which is a vaccine, as a solution was fine. But the problem is that we needed to also look at what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs, which basically is public health. Know where the infection is, have testing available, support people to isolate, give them good information, adequate financial support, etc., etc., and good data and share that between agencies. And I think some of those things were much tougher for us. But as I say, how countries do in a league table, it depends what you're measuring.
Actually, you're very elegantly polite there. I mean, make it tougher for us. I mean, I think in those areas that you've identified, you could say we were actually pretty damn poor. I mean, we didn't know what was going on in some of the less deprived parts of the country, and we didn't have we didn't make the right interventions quickly enough, and and that made the disease go on for longer. I mean, I think that's I would say, yeah, that's, no, fairly, no. I would say that's fairly clear, actually. I mean, although...
Yes, I mean, I think I always try to be, because I am seconded to the Scottish government, it's very important that I am, you know, try to be balanced in this. But I think everybody, and I wasn't advising government in the early stages of the pandemic, I started in September 2021, very late, is that... They're absolutely, everybody would acknowledge that the UK, if you look at our mortality and also the dipping in and out of lockdowns, those were things which were highly damaging. And there are many, many things about our response which absolutely need to be improved. And, you know, if you want to be really scathing, you can say that we were one of the worst countries in terms of managing the pandemic. And many, you know, a number of my colleagues would say that. I think the challenge is that... And in fact, I'm involved in Scotland's Standing Committee on Pandemics, which is trying to prepare for the next one. So we're trying to actively learn those lessons. It's a huge shock to the country. And one of the things that, you know, I, as a professor of public health, I wasn't just interested in the virus. I was chairing groups on children, education, young people, higher education, further education, community development, you know, later on in the pandemic. I was hearing every single week from teachers, parents, pupils, stakeholders about the real harms that were not about addressing the virus. They were about the other things that we did. And it's a really complex picture. We must do better next time. I think that's my focus now.
Just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from the cost of living crisis to the war in Ukraine, in every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff or Belfast. You'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. One of your kind of lifelong preoccupations has been the kind of public health dimension of smoking. And we had that quote from James I at the beginning of the podcast. It was fairly evident at the beginning of the 17th century that smoking didn't actually make you well. And yet, despite everything, we still have 14.5% of the UK population smoking. I mean, give us your assessment of that.
Well, this has sort of been my passion, nicotine tobacco research, for the last 25 years, as you rightly point out. And I think, you know, it's fundamentally changed in my lifetime. So the thing that a lot of people don't know is that in the 1950s and 60s, you know, 80% of men in the UK smoked. And we manufactured cigarettes and exported them to the world. You know, we were a huge producer of cigarettes, and it was totally normal. Women only got to about 47% of smoking in the 70s. They sort of followed on from males. So the fact that we've now got down to 14%, the second lowest rate of smoking in Europe, is a phenomenal achievement. But I often say that in 1962, the Royal College of Physicians produced a landmark report, Smoking and Health. And if you and I were to sit side by side now and look at that and go through the recommendations, you'd see that there are many, many of the things that we've done now, but it took 50 years to actually implement them all. So I would say it's been glacial progress, you know, and a really... It's hard to find anything. Well, there's no other commercial product that kills you, you know, when used as intended. If you follow the instructions, basically. smoking tobacco, combustible tobacco, and it is the burning that causes the bulk of the harm. It's phenomenally harmful. But why have we still got 14%? Well, I think, you know, it was deeply rooted in our society, deeply normal. And it's become, you know, a behavior that is associated with poverty now. Smoking rates are far, far higher in more deprived areas. And I think the problem is nicotine is really, really addictive. And until we can provide alternatives, which we started to do, You know, we still have a way to go. But my great hope, and I do think we're going to get there in my lifetime, and if you'd asked me that when I'd begun researching nicotine tobacco, I would not have been confident, is that smoking rates in young teenagers now are 1, 2, 3%. So we've made huge progress on prevention. The tricky thing is the older adults, particularly in midlife, in deprived areas who are still smoking, we're not doing enough to support them.
It's such a it's a story which is reproduced across the public health field, isn't it? But one of the things that I often cite smoking, and actually to it's not quite as dramatic in terms of public health terms, but no less important, kind of safety belts and putting kids in harnesses in the back seats of cars, as it took the legislators did not want to get ahead of the culture. And it took people like you and the Royal College of Physicians kind of making the case that began to produce the cultural change that then permitted, gave the political opening for regulation and legislation. In a way, it's a nice story because it suggests that actually effective laws require to be embedded in the culture. But another way, it's a disappointing story in the sense that when the case is so blisteringly obvious that legislators and regulators kind of don't act.
It is, and it's incredibly tricky. And it lets you, I mean, gambling, Will, is the modern example. You know, we are with gambling now in the UK. I mean, it's if you watch any football match, even the shirt, you know, it's just everywhere. And it's harming tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of families and people around the country now as an addictive behaviour. There's two things I would say about that. You're right. You have to take the public with you. You have to make the case over many years because it's not a virus. It's not killing an older family member now. It's the cancer you develop in 25, 30 years, or the heart disease or the diabetes. So it's not an immediate threat. We don't respond in the same way. So it is about making the case. But the fundamental difference is these public health issues, the main preventable risk factors for non-communicable diseases, cancer, heart disease, respiratory diseases, are alcohol, smoking, diet, these things, and their products, and this includes diet for unhealthy products, that are made by phenomenally powerful multinational companies with huge marketing budgets, and they will fight tooth and claw at every stage of the process in terms of regulation. So they are actually the major barrier to progress. And the problem is, as you know, politics with short lifespans, short election cycles, many politicians have relationships, either direct or indirect, with companies or companies who work for companies. And for me, and I've only come to realize this actually later in my career, where I'm doing more work now on the commercial determinants of health, that's basically the biggest problem that we have, and it's not easy to address.
Yes, it's sugar, isn't it, in drinks and kind of salt in processed foods. There's a huge resistance by the food and drinks kind of industry to the kind of regulation which would make people healthy. I mean, and yet, wearing another hat, there's a growth in investors in the investment community, asset managers and asset owners who invest our savings, who want to invest in companies that actually are sustainably doing the right thing. And there's a growing number of company leaderships that actually, you know, want to do that too. But it's, you know, not a critical mass.
We'll get there. Because, I mean, the tobacco-free portfolios, which was a real leader internationally led by a physician from Australia, working with companies, you know, for over several decades to encourage them to disinvest in tobacco stocks. We're now seeing that, as you say, in other sectors of the financial sector, and that is absolutely brilliant. So I think we can get there. But, you know, you raise the point about sugar or unhealthy diets. This did not happen by accident. I mean, I was born in 1970. The rates of obesity we have now, which are, you know, the majority of adults in the UK overweight or obese, they were not when I was born. It's not that the UK population woke up and decided they want to have unhealthy diets. Our diets change because of the products these companies are manufacturing. So I think we'll get there actually with some of the dietary factors. But if we use smoking as the model, and it often is the model actually, it just means people, the PhD students, the young scientists that I'm working with now, they have to, and the physicians, they have to be willing to stay in there for the long game because, you know, they won't see change quickly.
It is a 20-year game. It's a 25-year game. And I think even a 50-year game in the story of smoking. In one way, you can be pessimistic that, you know, the recommendation of the 1962 College of Physicians was not acted upon, and still parts of it remain unacted. On the other hand, we have got there, 60 years on. But Britain is on smoking. You earlier said that our record was really quite good compared with international comparison. There's lots of areas where we're poor, but why would that be? I mean, would maybe our colleagues in other countries would be saying, we can teach you, but in this area of smoking, maybe you can teach us.
I think we can, and I think I have some insights into that.
Well, come on, let's hear them. Come here, Linda. We've got to hear your insights.
It was so bad in the UK in terms of our rates, but we also did some of the first studies. And actually, some of the first people to quit smoking were British doctors. You see that from the British doctor study. Yeah. You know about that study, Will. It's phenomenal. And the Whitehall study followed afterwards, you know, similar methods. These are invaluable data sets. UK science is at its best in some of these big longitudinal studies. So we did the research, both in the lab and population, and we found out the harms, and it began to be communicated. And then, you know, the evidence filtered through to policymakers, and although it took many years, we did get there. But the other thing actually is one area where the research community has worked together in a coordinated way, and I don't see that in diet or physical activity or even in alcohol or some of these other topics, and we certainly haven't seen common ground always on COVID. We basically stopped competing in tobacco control research in the UK. We brought most of the key universities together, and I think we spoke with a united voice. And that's certainly from about 2000, certainly from, from the 2000s, helped us. And we got much more consensus. And interestingly, Will, we got cross-party consensus, even on things like standardized packaging, you know, which is quite amazing for right-wing governments to say, actually, you guys, companies, just remove all your branding. You can't advertise anymore. That's it.
I know. I mean, a pack of cigarettes cost you £10. So the pictures are fearsome on them. You know, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, only 1-3% of young people smoke. I mean, it's expensive and it's terrifying.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a story of hope, and social scientists contribute to that. And you know, we can solve all the problems, certainly not, but science does have a contribution to make.
What would be the parallel or the next target? I mean, diabetes, alcohol consumption, sugar consumption. What's your next target?
So in terms of public health, the areas I work in, which again is non-communicable disease prevention. So diet, you know, you could pick a condition, whether it be cancer, COPD, diabetes, these are all have common risk factors. I think the diet, nutrition, food policy issue is, as I said, 2/3 of adults overweight and obese. That increases their risk of all of those conditions other than respiratory conditions. Although we can worsen them. So that, I think we have to change our diet. We have to focus on food policy. And then the other issue I mentioned, which affects fewer people but is of deep concern to us, is gambling. I think for young people, for older people, we've got to curtail the activities of these companies. They're causing real harm. So the big one is diet. We must change that. And the one that I think is just so, so harmful and must be avoidable is gambling. So those are two really important topics in public health now. What I'd like us to do, and I would say this, is shift back to these chronic conditions, like some of them that can be prevented, rather than just infectious disease.
You're an expert in public health. You know a lot about the science. And yet, time and time again, the capacity to make real progress is about getting into these pockets of acute deprivation. And surely sometimes you must ring, you know, I don't know, driving back or cycling back from the university after a hard day at making this case, you must sometimes wonder, you know, to really get the kind of last mile, you've got to have a policy framework that deals with deprivation.
It is about poverty, and that's why in my work now with government, you know, I'm leading the cross-government cost crisis analytical group, learning from my colleagues. And all of our work actually has had to have an inequalities element. We live now in a more unequal society. You know, I was privileged to work with Michael Marmot and others over a number of years. The inequalities in our society are a major driver of health harms. And we're going to be heading into a winter despite government action. And I'm sure we'll continue to see government action at different levels of the UK will cause premature death and morbidity, disease, because of increased poverty, child poverty, fuel poverty. So it's really internationally the work I've done in Africa and South Asia. It's just such a huge issue, and that's why public health researchers have to work with others from many fields to make the case.
I mean, if you the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, working with assuming the energy price would not go up to the levels which it's not going to go up to now after the government's intervention, we're saying that by the end of 2024, 4 million households won't have completely exhausted their savings, and another million will be in total destitution. And the Resolution Foundation has similar numbers. What are the implications of that for public health?
The implications are really profound. And I mean, those two organizations are well regarded and are continuing to provide invaluable evidence, I think. So the public health implications, we know some of them from the past. Poverty, inequality, fuel poverty causes a series of things. The first is it's an immediate threat. So you have things like hypothermia. You have people with long-standing chronic conditions, who can't pay for transport to pick up their medicines or don't have access to adequate energy in their house to use the things that they need to keep them safe and well. So those are the immediate risks, and more vulnerable groups will be affected by that. Then there's the slightly indirect, but also quite immediate, which are excessive alcohol consumption, alcohol attributable mortality, which people lose hope. So you spend your money on that because it just helps you get through life. And the drugs death crisis we have in Scotland and across the UK, some of that will be affected.
Just to pick you up on that, I mean, that's a particular feature of Scotland.
I think if you look at drug deaths and maybe diet and alcohol consumption, we have made some progress on alcohol with some of our policies, but I think it's all wrapped up with poverty. I mean, people make joke about our weather. It's not a cultural thing. It's about just the real difficulties people have in life. And then when you live in those communities, and there's access to those products, they're cheap, affordable, attractive, and people around you consume them. That's how you get there. But actually, to be honest, as in terms of a research gap, it's sometimes called the Glasgow effect. Actually, my colleagues have looked at this. Glasgow in particular, actually, above and beyond the rest of Scotland, has a stronger clustering of these risky behaviours that are causing harms. We don't actually fully understand that. But just a final word on the cost of living crisis. There will be other effects which are longer term. So my colleague Carol Proper at Imperial College estimated in the 2008 recession, there were about 900,000 additional cases of disease and early death associated with that recession. So, there is previous work on this. So that's what we're going to see. And my personal hope, and that's why colleagues in the Academy of Social Sciences, working with other social scientists and others, is that we will see more policy action, both through this immediate crisis this winter, above and beyond what has already been committed, and, in the future. I really hope so.
Advise me. I mean, I'm the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. I mean, what would be the three things that actually you think we should really try to kind of foreground as we enter the winter?
Well, the first thing I would say is get active. So our social scientists need to be working with decision makers. Now, I would say this because I've tried to do this throughout most of my career, certainly over the last 15 years. I don't think us doing high quality, well-designed randomized control trials or prospective studies or whatever in universities is enough. You have to be making the case with government and understand how government works and get in there. And if it's not your evidence, find the colleagues who are doing the good work in universities and share their evidence with the policymakers. So that's my first ask. So just focusing on this immediate crisis. My second one is work with charities, work with the Resolution Foundation, the Poverty Alliance in Scotland, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, these amazing organisations we have in the UK that also use evidence and make the case and lobby governments. That's the second one. And the third one is think internationally. We're facing current crises now, but if we can collaborate within the social sciences with our colleagues in other countries, we have so much to learn from them. Whether you pick COVID, smoking, or economic crises, some countries do better, some countries do worse. And we have to share that knowledge, and academics have to be at the table contributing with their expertise, their analysis, and for some of them, their ability to interpret that and communicate it to decision makers. And many, many social scientists do this really well, but we need many, many more of them.
So flood the public sphere with great social science. Thank you so much for giving up your time. It's really been a very illuminating, and also to hear your passion, that you've managed to sustain your passion for public health. Because I think, to sum up what we've been hearing, is that actually good social science combined with good science and behavioural insights about how people actually respond to incentives and signals can actually move the culture. And if it moves the culture, you'll move the lawmakers and you move the regulation. And there's areas where that's provenly happened, as in smoking, and you now want to make it happen in food and in gambling. And I think you will. I think you will. I finished this podcast feeling rather optimistic. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.